we can view this as a zero form. A function is also a zero form. And then the wedge product with this one form, wedge product with another one form, etc. But the wedge product between a zero form and a one form is commutative. Therefore, we might just write it in shorthand way by just putting a multiplication in there. But really, you should think of it as a wedge product. Then the vector field, the vector field whose divergence we want to calculate can always be written as any vector field, as some linear combination that depends on the position in the manifold times the spacing. Then the divergence of the vector field is the lead derivative in the direction psi of the volume form. And we can evaluate that by using a Leibniz rule. How does that work? We have to evaluate the lead derivative of this, which is the lead derivative of that, keeping this the same, plus keeping this the same, lead derivative of that. Okay? And the lead derivative of this, of course, can be done by the product rule as well. So first we have to take the lead derivative of this, keeping that invariant. So the lead derivative of A of x is what? The lead derivative is a directional derivative. Oh, sorry to hear that we don't have work at the moment. With respect to the volume form omega. Guelph, are you there? Is Guelph there now? I can't tell. I hope so. Okay, so the lead derivative of a function in the direction of a vector field psi is what? What's the directional derivative of the function in the direction of psi? And what is the directional derivative? Remember, that is the vector field itself. So the vector field itself is a directional derivative. The lead derivative on a function is the vector field evaluated on the function. By times leaving all of that invariant, plus by the Leibniz rule, remembering that the lead derivative is a derivation, we keep this function in front the same, and then have to differentiate each one of those terms. So we have the sum of all of these terms, where each one of them individually gets differentiated with respect to the lead derivative. So we have to work out what the lead derivative is of p x I. What might that be? So the lead derivative of dxi is the directional derivative of the exterior derivative of xi. Do you remember how we defined the lead derivative on one form? We said that lead derivative viewed as the directional derivative should commute with the exterior derivative. So this is first exterior derivative, then lead derivative. That should be the same as first directional derivative, then exterior derivative. This is the directional derivative, that's the exterior. Same thing here, directional derivative, exterior derivative. Same thing. That's how we define the lead derivative on one form. Remember, the lead derivative on functions is simply the evaluation of the vector on the function. Then we also define the lead derivative on one form, namely by saying that the lead derivative, being a directional derivative, should commute with the exterior derivative, exactly this business. And then by the Leibniz rule, this has defined lead derivative on all differential forms. So here we are using this little commutativity right here. So we have the exterior derivative of the directional derivative. But what's the directional derivative of the coordinate function xi? Well, here we have the vector field spelled out, xi spelled out, acting on the coordinate function. That's not too hard to differentiate that. It just gives us the conjugate delta. So we get psi j delta ij. We are summing over all the frequency occurring indices, so that simply is psi I over here. At the end, we have to take the exterior derivative of the psi I. So we know how to do this. This is just a function, the psi I. And we know that the exterior derivative of the function is the differential of the function. So it's d psi I by PXR USR. This means that in such a term here, remember we have dx1 up to dxn. Each one of them has to be differentiated. When we are differentiating the dxi term, we will get this as the answer, which is a sum that involves dx1, dx2, dx3, and so on. But when we plug this sum in here, only one term will survive. And that's the term which is proportional to dxi, and r is equal to r. Because otherwise, we would have a doubling up. We would have, if this is dx1, if we take the dx1 term in here, then here is already dx1. We can use the commutativity and then the anti-commutativity, and then find out that the whole thing is actually zero, because the vector product is always anti-symmetric. So among all those terms in this sum, only one will survive. And that's the one where we have d psi I by d x I d x I. That's the one that goes into here. And that means that you can write the divergence of the vector field in this way. Namely, this term here becomes psi I d by d x I. That's psi I a comma I. This is d by d x I of a. And this term here, see, here's a dx I term multiplied with d psi I by dx I. So we can put in front of you. Too long on that slide. So we have I a times psi I comma I. That's this term for r equal to r. Sum over all I, because we have it occurring for each. This we can also write in terms of the volume form again. The volume form is A times this basis vector. So we can write the divergence now using this as 1 over A times this business times omega. The omega has an A in it that just cancels this 1 over A. And then this is the product of two functions, the a of x and the psi I, differentiated with respect to d by dxi. That gives us two terms in the AI set. Those two. Right? So this is a useful thing to know, and we will occasionally refer back to this. So far, we have quite a few differentiations. It's not enough. We get more of them. So far, we have the exterior derivative, we have the inner derivation, we have the lead derivative. And we know how to integrate n forms over n dimensional manifolds and p forms over p dimensional submanifolds. We also have a notion of volume now in the manifold, but we still don't have a notion of distance between points. It might seem at first that we do have a notion of distance. But we don't really. And that's because the numerical distance between the coordinates of two points, let's say one point has coordinates x1 to xn, and another point has coordinates x1 plus epsilon 1 plus up to xn plus epsilon n, then the coordinate distance, those epsilon, say nothing about the distance of the two points. I'm not saying that we don't get the information out. I'm saying the information is not there. If you just have an abstract manifold, there is no notion of how close or how far apart two points are. Because you could always use a chart in which they're close, and then another chart in which they're very far away, as far as the numerical distance is concerned. If you want to have a notion of distance between two points on a manifold, obviously this distance must be coordinate system independent. We already have a coordinate system independent notion of volume, but for that purpose, we had to introduce a volume form. If we now want to have a coordinate system independent notion of distance, we would have to introduce, again, a tensor. Because a tensor is obviously something that is coordinate system independent. It takes different shapes in different coordinate systems, but it is abstractly a thing that is independent of which chart you used to look at. let us recall how this works in special relativity. If two events, P and Q, have coordinates, let's say from x0 to x3, and from x0 plus epsilon 0 to x3 plus epsilon 3, then in an inertial coordinate system, their covariant distance is given in this way. You take one vector's coordinate minus the other vector's coordinate and square the coefficient and make sure that you take the negative of the time variable. That gives you the invariant distance. We know from special relativity that this invariant distance is the same no matter in which inertial coordinate system you calculate. Whether you are moving fast or moving slowly makes a difference for those numbers, but not for the difference squared in this way. Now, by the equivalence principle, and remember I reviewed that in the very first lecture that was assigned reading, by the equivalence principle, there always exists local inertial coordinate system in which this, in which special relativity still holds. If you're in free fall, then at least in a small neighborhood of you, you will find that the laws of special relativity still hold. This is the equivalence principle. Which means that at least in some small neighborhood around any given point, the postulate of the equivalence principle is that with arbitrary precision, special relativity still holds. In order to make it more and more precise, you may have to make this region more and more small. But in principle, you can suppress the error that you make by making the region in which you look around your point arbitrarily small. So this leads us to the definition of a pseudo-Riemannian metric on a manifold as a covariant two tensor field. It will play the role for the distances that the volume form plays for the definition of the volume. So the metric, the metric tensor, being a twofold covariant tensor field, is an assignment of that gives you, for every point of the manifold, an element of the space of twofold covariant tensors. But not every twofold covariant tensor qualifies for being a candidate for a metric. You would require that the metric tensor viewed as a twofold covariant tensor, and therefore as a dual tensor to a twofold contravariant tensor, can, it can feed on two tangent vectors and will give you a number. At every point, this is what it does. It is a linear map, it's a bilinear map that feeds on two tangent vectors and gives you a real number. It will require that this map is symmetric. For this reason, the reason being that the distance formula that we had from special relativity was symmetric. Then, at every point of the manifold, we also want that the metric fed through tangent vector is zero for all psi, first argument, if and only if the second argument is actually the zero vector. This is just a fancy way of saying it's invertible, that it has no kernel. So we say in this case that the metric is non-degenerate.
Because in the above thing, you said that G was a map from M to TPM.
Yeah.
And in the second line, you wrote that G is a map from Xi and eta to R. So
right. So you can view as G, as of G, the metric, as a, if you view it as a covariant two tensor vector field, two tensor field, then it maps point of the manifold into a twofold cotangent, twofold covariant vector at each point.
But then this two-fold covariance vector at each point is also called a metric at this point. So the word metric has two meanings. It's a metric field, but it could also be a metric at a point. And as a metric at a point, it can feed on two attention vectors and give you a number.
If you give it a point and then you take two tangent vectors at that point, and then that metric acts on those two tangent vectors and gives you a real number.
Yes, that's right. Okay, so the metric tensor has to be two-fold covariance symmetric from the gem. The metric G is called a Riemannian metric if the metric of when fed two tangent vectors that are the same is positive, and a differentiable manifold together with a either Riemannian metric or pseudo-Riemannian metric, if it's not necessarily positive, is called a Riemannian manifold, or if it's not necessarily positive, then it's called a pseudo-Riemannian manifold. For example, in space-time, we know that this is not always positive, and it will be a pseudo-Riemannian manifold. How does the metric look like in a basis? Let's assume that the theta I are some choice of bases in the cotangent vector space at the point P. We can choose the theta I to be the dxi that comes with the coordinate system. But of course, in principle, we can choose those theta I to be any basis we like. So assume that the theta I are a basis of our tangent space at the point P. Sorry, of the cotangent space, sorry. Then we know that theta I tensor theta j, these combinations for bases of the tensor space of covariant two tensors. Therefore, the metric has to be a linear combination of those with some function over there. The metric now viewed as a field, a two-fold covariant field. Let's further assume that the EI are the dual bases to the theta I. So remember, that means that the EI evaluated on the theta j gives you a conical delta I j. In the case that we choose for the theta I, the dxi that come with the choice coordinate, the dual basis is the d by dxi. Obviously, right? If you apply this one on that, just get the conical delta. That's just what I wrote here. Then the metric can be evaluated. See, the metric is in general a linear combination of those basis vectors. And we can feed it two tangent vectors to get out a number. If we do that, we obtain that the metric fed two tangent vectors gives us this combination here, where this is fed the first tangent vector, that's fed the second tangent vector, that just gives us conicals, and so we end up with GRS. So, what you have to keep in mind here is that the GRS are not themselves the tensor, they're just coefficients in a basis. Now, a manifold is called Lorentzian if for all points in the manifold there are charts such that the metric, those numbers here, take the form of this Lorentzian metric here. This is to say that a Lorentzian manifold is always the pseudo-Riemannian manifold. But of course, not every pseudo-Riemannian manifold is a Lorentzian. Because you could have, for example, two minus signs in there, and you wouldn't call it a Lorentzian manifold, but you would call it a pseudo-Riemannian manifold. So by the equivalence principle, what we want is to describe space-time as a Lorentzian manifold. So we're done with which is And it turns out that
the notion of metric that we put on a manifold so that we can at least locally define distances, that is, at least locally, we can calculate the covariant distances just like in special relativity. That notion is actually more general than the notion of volume form. Having a metric induces for us a volume form, which is perhaps not surprising. If you know how to measure distances, then you should be able to measure volumes as well. So there should be a volume form that is induced, that is the natural volume form that arises from our choice of metric. In principle, you're not obliged to use that one. You could have one metric that is used for calculating distances and a volume form that's totally unrelated to it. It would be mathematically consistent. But of course, physically speaking, it's awkward if you don't calculate the volume the same way that you would do normally by building it up, calculating the length.
And then multiplying those lengths. So how then is it that the metric is inducing a volume form? Let's assume, as always, that our manifold is oriented, which means that it has an atlas consisting of charts which have mutual Jacobian determinants wherever they overlap, which are positive. Then consider some positive chart, which is a chart which has positive Jacobian determinants with respect to all of the charts of the atlas that make N oriented. Then the claim is that this is a volume form. So the volume form is claimed, the volume is claimed to be a volume form. Take this basis vector here of N forms, multiply it with this function here, the square root of the absolute value of the determinant. How do we see that this is a well-defined volume form? Why don't we take the, not the square root, but the third root, or 27th root? Why not? That's the reason why we take the square root. First of all, this definition is good insofar as it's certainly positive. It is never zero. Remember that we had a condition on the metric, which was that it was non-degenerate. And that means that its determinant is never zero, which is to say that this is already one of the properties that you want a volume form to have, never to be zero. So that is OK. Now we also have to check whether it is indeed definition, whether this definition is really chart independent. See, could it not be that if we choose a chart, and we take our metric, calculate this, get a certain volume form? Now let's say I choose another chart, and I write this down. Do I really get the same volume form? In this case, the answer is yes, and I will show you in a moment why. But if we had written here, let's say, the 27th power of the determinant of G, then it wouldn't be the case. Then the volume form that you get this way depends on which coordinate system you calculate it in, where you define it. We want this to be, of course, a definition that you could write down in any coordinate system, and it would give you the same volume form. Let's verify that the square root will do the trick. So this end, let's remember how the metric is transformed. The metric is twofold covariant, which means that it transforms with respect to these Jacobian matrices, something we established before. We can write this as matrices. Think of this as a matrix. After all, it has two indices. And here, we have again a matrix, and another matrix. We can also view this as the G tilde matrix being this matrix times G times that matrix. It's just the product of three matrices. Take the determinant of this, of the left-hand side and the right-hand side. Then you have the determinant of G tilde, the determinant of the Jacobian squared and the determinant of G. Which is to say that the square root of the determinant of G is proportional to the determinant of the Jacobian times the square root of G. Now, let us look how the other part is transformed. Remember that we defined the volume form to consist of the product of this and that. We know now how this is transforming if we go to another coordinate system. Namely, it will pick up a factor of a Jacobian matrix. Now, how does this transform as we go into a different chart? It will pick up just the inverse of that factor. We established that G tilde will have an addition, the square root of G tilde will have an additional determinant of the Jacobian. But these guys are transforming with the determinant of the x tilde by the x, which is the inverse of that. Which means that overall, if we write down this expression that we want to use as a volume form in the tilde coordinate system, then it is related to the same expression in the untilded coordinate system, up to those two factors, one of them coming from transforming this and the other one coming from transforming that. And since they're just the inverse of another, there's really no factor in between. And therefore, we can write down this expression in any coordinate system we like. We never have to worry about additional factors. It's a coordinate system in any definition. This sort of thing is easily overlooked, but you have to check that, otherwise you're doing physics as coordinate system independent, and therefore nonsense. And that is a coordinate system dependent, and that has to be avoided. This, we will from now on always work with this volume form, with the volume form that is induced from the metric. So we will always measure volumes as arising from length measurements.
So, excuse me, unfortunately, I have another question. So the metric is supposed to give you a distance. Now if a metric is supposed to give you a distance, then you must feed it in 2 points. And then it gives you a distance. But here we have only fed it 1 point. And then we are taking 2 times.
No, at every point, you have a neighborhood in which special relativity holds. And you can calculate then the invariant distance between two events using just the usual Minkowski metric. With the -1 and the +1. If you use a coordinate system of a free-falling observer. But you can use another coordinate system as well. And then this metric may look much more complicated, but you can still use it. So you evaluate the metric at 1 point, but that allows you then to calculate distances to linear order. We will get to this in detail later on. So omega is an n-form, and when I write down omega now, I would always mean the square root of the absolute value of the determinant times the theta of 1 to theta n. Now there's a very convenient tensor, the Levi-Civita tensor, which is useful in many circumstances, but in particular also to write down the volume form. The Levi-Civita tensor is defined as a totally anti-symmetric tensor that has entry +1 if its arguments are all numbers from 1 to n in an even permutation. It's -1 if its indices run through all numbers from 1 to n. But in an odd permutation, n is 0 otherwise. So if one number occurs twice, it's 0. It's totally anti-symmetric, and it is 1 if the indices are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, etc. up to n. And then whenever you change, whenever you swap indices, you get a -1. Using this epsilon tensor, we can define we can rewrite our volume form, our metric induced volume form that we had defined in this way. We can rewrite it in this way. Namely, remember the definition of the wedge product. This totally anti-symmetrized sum of the tensor product. And therefore, we can just use this instead of using either the projector onto the anti-symmetric size tensors or some other complicated definition. It's just an easy bookkeeping device at this point. So that allows us to write the volume form also as a tensor, not just as a form. We write it as a tensor, an n-tensor, n-fold covariant tensor with these indices. Where those indices are simply the square root of d times the epsilon. So viewed as a form, it simply has the square root of g. Viewed as a tensor, it also has that. The metric induced this volume form, and so it is also called the metric volume form, or the canonical or pseudo-Riemannian volume form. The metric is important throughout what we follow in this course, because it is what we give the manifold its shape. Remember that before we introduced the metric, we had no idea how to calculate the distance between two points of the manifold, not for lack of technology, but for the fact that there was no distance. You just have an abstract manifold, abstract differential manifold, then there is no distance between two points, no notion of distance between them. So that the charge depends. But with the metric, you can now define it. And that in turn means that the manifold now acquires a shape independent of the coordinate system in which you look at it. But just imagine if you have a catalog, a complete catalog of what the distances are between any two points. This catalog will allow you to reconstruct how the manifold looks. So all information about the shape of the manifold is in the metric. Now, one very important application of this information is calculating the D'Alembert operator for the Laplace operator, which is needed for writing down wave equation. Remember that the D'Alembert operator that you have, for example, in the Klein-Gordon equation. Has everybody seen the Klein-Gordon equation before? Who has not seen the Klein-Gordon equation? So a few of you. All right. So it is, you can view it as the relativistic generalization of the Schrödinger equation. And in the Schrödinger equation, you have the time derivative, and you have the Laplace operator for the space derivatives. A fully covariant version that involves both the time and the space derivatives is the Laplace, or more generally, the D'Alembert operator, where everything is second derivatives, even with respect to time. So in order to define this Laplace or D'Alembert operator, generally, we need to define a covariant version of a non-directional second derivative. The Laplace operator doesn't prefer any direction. It's a scalar operator, not the vector operator. It's a scalar thing. It doesn't have any particular direction. And it's a second derivative. We haven't had such an animal before. We've only worked with derivations. And all derivations are like the first derivative. So you obey the product rule. A second derivative doesn't obey the product rule. Well, it obeys one, but it won't. I mean, you can work out what it is. It's not the simple Laplace rule, it's the more complicated one. Also, the Laplace operator, and similarly the D'Alembert operator, the difference between the two is only the difference in the signature of the metric. If the metric has only positive entries, you would call it the Laplace operator. And if the metric has one minus sign and the rest pluses, so you have a Lorentzian metric, in that case you would call it the D'Alembert operator. But then, of course, you can look at manifolds that have any number of minus signs in the metric and any number of plus signs. In that general case, it's often called the Laplace operator. So the Laplace operator is, in mathematics, considered to be the more general term. And the Dahlonbert operator would apply to relativity in particular. Now the Laplace operator, as does the Dahlonbert operator, maps functions into functions, which is to say it maps zero forms into zero forms, and therefore we would like it to be preserving the degree of a form. It should map one form into one form and two forms into two forms. Just as we know it, what it does for Rn, it should also do that for arbitrary manifolds. In order to be able to do this, we will have to go through four steps. It won't be completely clear at this point why we have to do those four steps, but they all are needed for the purpose. First of all, we will see how the metric relates covariant and contravariant tensors to raising and lowering of indices that you probably have seen before. You can probably do this, but that won't take very long. And then we define a map that looks very innocent but is rather powerful. It's the so-called Hodge star map, which we map R forms into n minus R forms. Because n is the dimension of the manifold. Which will map, for example, functions into n forms, and n forms into functions. We would use this to define the so-called co-derivative, which is, in a specific sense, the adjoint operator to the exterior derivative. And then we can use this co-derivative together with the exterior derivative to define our Dahlonbert or Laplace operator in this case. Very similar to how we define the Lie derivative. The Lie derivative was the exterior derivative times the inner derivative plus the inner times the exterior derivative. Here, we have the exterior times the co-derivative plus the co-derivative the exterior. Once we have the Dahlonbert operator, we can then write down an equation like this. The Klein-Gordon equation. On flat space, it would be simply the second time derivative minus the second space derivative. Okay, so how to do this? First of all, the metric can be used as a map. As a map from contravariant vector fields into covariant. Or just from a contravariant vector, from contravariant vectors at the point into covariant vectors at the point. Why is that? Well, the metric can map a tangent vector field, element of this space, a tangent vector at the point. It can map into a cotangent vector simply by using the fact that the metric is twofold covariant. So we can see one of its arguments, a tangent vector, and then that will produce a number times the second of its components, which is cotangent. So the metric is given like this in general. So it's a linear combination of these basis vectors. And then we simply feed this basis vector here, that tangent vector. And what does that give? Well, you know, these bases are annihilating each other, just giving us a Kronecker delta. Theta nu ei is delta nu I. And that means that the outcome of that map is this covariant vector. See, this is a function here times this covariant basis vector. So overall, we have that the metric is mapping a tangent vector into a cotangent vector. These are the components of the tangent vector, and these are the components of the cotangent vector that we obtain. I'm writing this all with these bases and so on because I would like to get you used to the idea of working with arbitrary bases in the tangent space and in the cotangent space. Later on, this will be very important. When you've had the first course in general relativity, you probably automatically used the basis that was suggested by the choice of coordinate system, the d by dxi, and for as the basis of the tangent space. and the dxi, the differentials, as a basis of the cotangent space. But you don't have to use those bases, and there's a lot of benefit that you gain by freeing yourself from a choice that is attached to the coordinate system, because the coordinate system has no physics to it. But you can choose your bases conveniently to be adapted to the physics that's going on later on. So we do all of this in a basis-independent way, which means, in particular, let me just point it out already, you may think that the metric tensor, as a matrix-valued function of space and time, is generally some complicated function that a matrix-valued function whose entries depend on the coordinate system. That is not so. That is not so at all. It's only so if you choose the basis that comes with the choice of coordinates. If you choose your basis freely, then you can always arrange that your metric tensor is, for example, just the Minkowski tensor with a minus one and a plus one, plus one, plus one, at every point at once. Just by choosing your basis in the cotangent space suitably and independently from the coordinate system that you choose. So don't think that those values, g nu rho of x, depend on the coordinate system. They don't. They depend, well, depend on the coordinate system, but also on your choice of the basis vectors up there. They depend on the coordinate system if you choose those to come from the, if you choose the basis vectors to come from the coordinate system. If you choose them not to come from the coordinate system, then it's totally up to you what those things are. What values those matrices take. So the inverse metric, the inverse metric tensor, is a twofold contravariant tensor thing. I'm just stating that here, of course, it would require proof that this indeed is a contravariant, twofold contravariant tensor, but it's not so hard to show. This then can be viewed as a map from contravariant tensors to, from covariant tensors to contravariant tensors. And of course, what it does is it is raising the indices in the way that you've seen before. Just keep in mind that we are free to choose the basis, and the matrix may look very different from what you would get if you chose the basis that comes with the point. Okay, so we've recovered what you've most likely seen before, namely that you can use the metric to raise and lower indices. Now we come to this mysterious map, the Hodge-Star map. Hodge-Star map, at the moment when I first define it, I don't think it will make any sense why would we would do this. It's not hard to see what it does, but why would we want it? We'll get to that in a moment. So this is going to be a map that maps p forms into n minus p forms. For example, space-time is four-dimensional. It will map zero forms into four forms. It will map one form into three forms, and two forms into two forms. So the idea is this. Each p form is a covariant tensor. It's a differential form, all right, but every differential form is also a tensor. It's an anti-symmetric tensor. That's the only thing that's special about it. Now, we can use the metric to raise all of its indices. Then we obtain another tensor that we may call, that we may call a new tilde. And that tensor is it is now just like the original tensor that was differential form, but you know we can't use it the way we can use differential form. For example, we can't use it in different. Because remember, the total anti-symmetry was needed of differential forms in order to be suitable for integration, but also they had to be covariant in order to get the Jacobian factor right. So the new tilde is not a differential form at all. though it might be a Tesla metric, it is not having the right transformation properties. It's contravariant rather than covariant. But now what we can do with this tensor nu tilde is that we can feed it into the volume form. The volume form is waiting to feed on n contravariant vector fields, or on, well, it has n open slots for contravariant vector fields, n indices to contract. And we can contract with the contravariant indices that this new tilde brings. So if this is a P form, then its contravariant version will have P indices that are contravariant. We can feed those P contravariant indices into the volume form. It really is waiting for n inwards. We only give it P, which means that n minus P covariant indices are still available, which means that the outcome of that operation here is an n minus P form. This is what this Hodge star will do. The Hodge star takes the P form and raises its indices to make it contravariant, and then feeds it into the volume form so that we are left with an n minus p form. So concretely, we take a differential form in this way, and for convenience, we define here the coefficients in front with the 1 over p factorial, just for combinatorial reasons, because then we can, when we, this term will go away when we write this as a tensor product. So we have now our differential P form, mu, viewed as a covariant tensor, totally endosymmetric covariant tensor. Now we use the inverse metric to make it contravariant. So we simply raise all of the indices, and then we obtain a new tensor, mu tilde, which is contravariant. Because those upstairs coefficients are obtained from the lower ones simply by raising using the metric. Now we feed this contravariant P vector into a P tensor into the volume form. The volume form is waiting. See, again, the volume form we are writing as a tensor rather than as a differential form. So now we feed this volume form the our contravariant tensor nu tilde. And that will eat up P of its open slot and gives us with n minus p of them. And these are the n minus p of them that are left over. P indices have been contracted with the indices of the volume. So the first indices from i1 to ip are contracted with this. And then the remaining indices from ip plus 1 to in are contracted with this. Overall, this whole thing now is an n minus p form. And we define the Hodge star to be the map that achieves this. Feed it a p form and get out the n minus p form that is obtained by feeding the contravariant version of mu into the volume. And concretely, it's just this in coefficients. So here's a proposition. What do we get if we apply the Hodge star operation twice? We should get something that's pretty similar to what we started with. Because after all, we take, let's say, a one form in spacetime, apply the Hodge star to it, and we get a three form. If we apply the Hodge star on a three form, we get a one form. Now, there are no other tensors involved than the original tensor that we started with, the new and the volume form. If we're lucky, we get back the original form. we get back the original form up to this combination of terms that will result in either plus time or minus time. In the case of space-time, this S here, the signature, is 1, and P is the degree of the form. P form, again, is the dimension of the form. So the signature here, the signature S in this case, is if the manifold has R plus signs and S minus signs, then the number of minus signs is this number S over here. Again, it's a little exercise to prove this. Now, what's the purpose of all of this star business? So the purpose of it is to use it to define the so-called codifferential. The codifferential operator is going to be something like a mirror version of the exterior derivative. The exterior derivative is mapping p forms into p plus 1 form. The codifferential will do the opposite. It will map p forms into p minus 1 forms. Why did we want that? Well, remember that we want eventually to define the Laplace operator or Dannenberg operator to write down wave equations. But those operators, Laplace and Dannenberg, are supposed to map zero forms into zero forms, one forms into one forms, and so on. They shouldn't change. The Laplace operator should not change the degree of the differential form. But the exterior derivative does it. It changes the degree of the form. And we can't simply use the square of the exterior derivative to get a second derivative, because the square of the exterior derivative is zero.
Why don't you use the inner?
We tried that and we got the leader of it.
Yes.
Exactly. So,
so but why can't
which
we
is to the first derivative. Right? Because the inner derivative has no derivative in it. It's a derivation, but it has no derivative.
And Elzeit's square was zero again.
No? No, it's not. But it's a directional derivative. The Laplacian is not supposed to be directional derivative. It's not supposed to prefer any direction. The Laplacian is supposed to be a scalar operator. So the codifferential then is defined in the following way. The codifferential is defined to be what you get up to this minus sign business, which is really a convention. I mean, you can define that away if you want to. The codifferential is mapping a P form into Hochstar D Hochstar applies to this P form. What is it doing? Well, you take the P form, apply the Hochstar to it. What you get is an N minus P form. Okay? Then you apply the exterior derivative. That raises the degree. So you get an N minus P plus 1 form. Now you apply the Hochstar to that. And what you get then? You get a P minus 1. It's the angle of the wave. So N minus within bracket, N minus P plus 1, bracket closed, is. So that means the codifferential will map P forms into P minus 1. And in particular, it will map zero forms, for example, into not minus one forms. There aren't any. It will map zero forms into zero. And how do we see that? Well, take a zero form here. The hot star will map it into a n form. And then the exterior derivative of an n form would be an n plus one form. But there is no such thing because you can't anti-symmetrize so many covariant indices if the dimension is n. Key properties of the codifferential. The codifferential square is zero, which is clear for the following reason. The exterior derivative squared is zero, and the Hochstar squared is also essentially zero, up to some decorative minus one. So the fact that the codifferential squared is zero is really inherited from the fact that the exterior derivative squared is zero. In coordinates, the exterior derivative does the following. And again, it's a little exercise to show that. If you take your differential form, and you want to know how does it look like when you raise its indices after you take a differential form, take the co-derivative, and then it's still a differential form, and now you raise the indices, then you get this expression over here. I raise the indices here because if I had written it with a lower indices, I would have had to put a lot of matrix over here that lower the indices. Now the co-derivative inherits even more from the exterior derivative. It also inherits the following proposition here. If the manifold is contractible, then if the co-derivative is a zero, then there exists a differential form of which our mu is the co-derivative. This is just like what we had for the exterior derivative. If a form, a differential form is closed, to say its exterior derivative is zero, then if the manifold is contractible, there exists a differential form of which it is the exterior derivative, is to say that it is exact. Now, of course, every manifold is locally contractible, so locally you always have that it is exact. There is always a differential form of which it is the exterior derivative, or in this case, the co-derivative. Just another version of the Poincaré lemma. And in fact, as we will later see, the co-derivative is really the exterior derivative. It's just the adjoint of it. And so in Hilbert space, it's just the adjoint of it. I'm a bit worried because I see myself twice instead of Guelph once. Are you there in Guelph? Are you lost then? Okay, so finally we are ready to find the Laplacian for the D'Alembert. Just that D'Alembert is the name of it if the signature of the spacetime is as that of the manifold is as that of spacetime. In the case of spacetime, we speak of the D'Alembert. In general, the term is the Laplacian. We define it to be the anti-commutator of the co-derivative and the exterior derivative. So just this expression over here. Some people put an overall minus sign in front of this. Even myself, just two slides back. Sorry, my notation is not consistent here. I have to fix this. So. Now the Laplace operator is a very important operator. We know now from this definition right away that it's going to map P forms into P forms. Because the co-differential is going to lower the degree of a differential form on which it acts, but the exterior derivative undoes raising it by one and flips the other way around. So certainly the thing is going to map P forms to the P forms. Also, this is a second derivative because both the exterior derivative and the co-derivative are regular derivatives. And certainly it is a coordinate system independent definition. And as I said, in the case of the Minkowski signature, where there's just one minus sign occurring in electric, it would be called the D'Alembert operator. How does it act in practice? I'd like to leave that to you as an exercise. Show that the D'Alembert operator, you will usually now use this box symbol instead of the triangle. The triangle is a more general term. You can always use, no matter whether it's a Riemannian or pseudo-Riemannian manifold. In the case of spacetime, we use the box, and we will generally use the box in the future. the expression that we obtain for its action on a function is this, which reduces, in the case of a constant metric on Minkowski space, so if you just use the Cartesian coordinates on Minkowski space, then all of this reduces simply to the second derivative of the function with the proper sign, minus sign for the time component. But this is really what you get in general. If you plug that into a coordinate system. But remember that this is only the action of the Dalembergian on zero forms, functions. There is an action of the Dalembergian also on one forms, two forms, etc. It's a little bit more complicated. Now, where does the Laplacian arise? Well, in particular, the Laplacian arises in the Kalmogorov action. So for those of you who have not seen this, and also this in a little bit of detail, remember that any physical dynamics can be described as an action principle. In particular, if you have a scalar field living on space-time, then the action that is assumed for the scalar field is the so-called Kalmogorov action. So phi is a kind of Gordon field, it's a scalar function, it's an element of instead of zero forms. And S is a function. So you plug in your field, you get out a number. And how do you get this number? Well, you take the field, you take its particle in the x mu direction, what you obtain, you contract with the metric. Here you have a two-fold contravariant tensor. Here you have two cotangent vectors, and so they contract to give you a function, a zero form, therefore. This is the volume form. Therefore, you have a zero form times a n form, and that overall gives you an n form, which you can then integrate over the n-dimensional spacetime. More explicitly, you have this tangent vector acting on phi, that tangent vector on phi, and the other metric. And well, volume form is the volume form that is induced by the metric. So this is how it looks like explicitly. Then what happens if you integrate by part? So you have the first derivative on phi here, first derivative on phi there. In order to calculate the Euler Lagrange equations, you want to be able to functionally differentiate with respect to phi, not just its derivative. So you want to do a partial integration by parts. What happens then? If you integrate by parts, then you get a derivative acting on this and that and this. Okay? We assume that we can throw away boundary terms. Then after the integration by parts, you get an overall minus sign, and you get this derivative acting on all of this stuff, namely on this, on that, and on this. Okay? Now here we have again a factor of the volume form. I arranged for that factor by multiplying and dividing by it. Therefore, we can write the Kalmogorov action also in this form, where we have the field and then some second derivative operator acting on the field here times the volume form. Okay. So what I did was I started off with those first derivatives, which we know, of course, just partial derivatives. There's nothing fancy about differentiating a function. And then integrated by part, we also get the second derivative. And then we can call this second derivative operator here, this thing here, the Dalembergian. If we do that, we indeed obtain exactly what we obtained abstractly from this definition here. I left it to you as an exercise to show that from this definition, you obtain that expression when applied to zero forms. And what I just showed you is that you obtain this very same expression also if you take the Kleinbornian action in this form, do an integration by parts, and connect everything that looks like a second derivative together and call it the double measure. So this box is simply all of this stuff. That's exactly the same thing as what we had over here. Okay, so we seem to be on the right track there. And the Kleinbornian wave equation is obtained by taking the action and calculating the other Lagrange equation. Is there anybody who has not done other Lagrange equations?
I just have a question.
Ah, you have a question, okay.
Before the page before, where's the part, what are where does the integration take place to go to zero? Because there's one part of the integration by parts that went away.
Yeah.
There was a definite integral there.
Yeah, in principle, you are integrating over all of Rn, and you're assuming that the field and its derivative go to zero at infinity. Oh. That's why you saw weighted boundary terms. Oh. You have to be a little bit more careful when we use later on with things that involve the metric, because we can't assume the metric to go away.
Okay.
A field can go away, but the metric can't go away. So boundary terms are important for gravity. Okay, so remember the Euler Lagrange equation looked like that for fields. And in our case, the Lagrangian is this, where the box operator was a little bit complicated, remember? And it's clear, however, from this that we obtain as the Euler Lagrange equation simply the Bellman version acting on phi is equal to zero. This is the Kleinbornian equation on the curves manifold. Looks simple, but you really have to plug in this complicated thing. For example, in the cosmological inflation, as we will later see, this is the equation that we have to study. And all the non-triviality comes from the non-triviality of the Dunham version. So which physical fields are described by Klein-Gordon fields? Well, so far we don't know of any for sure. There are two very important candidates, though. One is the inflation field of cosmology. The idea there is that a scalar field did two things at the very beginning of the universe. One is that its energy led to a temporary cosmological constant that made the universe expand in a quasi-exponential fashion very early on, which would have diluted everything that might have been there completely, so that the universe started out pretty much empty and pretty much flat, simply because it was stretched by an enormous amount very, very quickly. Now that would have in itself, classically speaking, that would have left a pretty boring universe. Everything that might have been there before was completely diluted away because of this enormous increase of volume, and any wrinkles even that would have been there in the space-time initially would have been ironed out simply by the large expansion of everything.
So expansion just means that the things move outwards.
Yeah, it means that the space-time itself becomes bigger. So any small wavelength wrinkle would have become a very, very, very large wavelength wrinkle, but then it looks pretty flat. Okay? So that would have been a pretty boring universe, but the quantum fluctuations of a scalar field behave differently from the quantum fluctuations of a vector or a tensor field, and the quantum fluctuations of a scalar field in particular could have seeded the inhomogeneities of the universe. So in principle, the inflation field would have created a blank sheet, so to speak, so the enormous expansion, but then the quantum fluctuation would have imprinted inhomogeneities that would have seeded the galaxies and anything we see in the universe now. So we would be the result of quantum fluctuations of a scalar field described by the Kleinbornian field. And of course, that's our aim eventually in this course, to understand exactly how this goes. Not quite the quantum part, but as much as we can say about the classical part.
But dilution is not the same thing as destruction.
That's right. Yeah, and then there's another candidate for that was this inflaton field here. And this is really the standard model of inflation of cosmology nowadays. All the evidence points towards it. Of course, we are trying to go beyond that. We are questioning this model, but it's the most successful so far. Yes, and then there are then there's a so-called Higgs field, which is supposed to be responsible for the symmetry breaking in the standard model of particle physics, and therefore is providing the mechanism that gives the mass to particles. See, if we hadn't got a Higgs field, a scalar field described by the Cantor equation, then the masses of particles would break some of the symmetry that we think are in the standard model. Therefore, it seems needed. Now, there is a big effort, of course, underway at CERN to try to find those Higgs particles. A lot of energy is needed to produce them if they exist, but there's good hope that they might be found. And if so, then there is the initial, those who initially proposed the existence of the Higgs fields were Proud, Engler, and Higgs would probably share some Swedish prize. There are other scalar fields out there that are pretty well described by the Cantor equation, in the meson field, so, but they are not fundamental. They are composite particles, quadratic ones. Among fundamental scalar fields, we haven't really observed the particles just yet, but there's very good evidence that there are Higgs fields and that there is an interton field.
Can I make a comment?
Yep.
Actually, Higgs field originally came from Collins matter, and there actually there is a Landau-Hilbert theory for superconductivity, which which people already got a nice Swedish prize, Swedish prize in 2003. Well, so basically, Higgs field is physical in a phenomenological sense.
Well, yeah, that's right. But again, it's just like a meson. It's not a fundamental, it's a composite. It would be a collective excitation rather than an elementary particle. What I was saying is that we haven't got an elementary scalar. And you're right, another phenomenon in the history of physics is that condensed matter physics has inspired a lot of high energy physics. And spontaneous symmetry breaking was really handled first in condensed matter and then in particle physics. And that's where Proud and Engler started, actually, from that. Now, let's change our intuition a little bit. Namely, the normal intuition is that we have started out with is that if you knew a table of all the distances between any two points of the manifold, then you could reconstruct how the manifold looks like. This, however, is not how, in practice, how the shape of the manifold is being dealt with. Instead, let's put it another way. The fact that those distances are not trivial exhibits itself in the fact that Pythagoras' law is not true. It is true as far as mathematics is concerned. If you start with certain axioms, then you get that Pythagoras can be derived. But in real life, in space-time, Pythagoras doesn't hold because those axioms don't hold. We don't live in Euclidean space, we live in a curved space. And you can prove that Pythagoras is not true either, and you can just use laser beams and so on. Angles don't add up to 180 degrees, and a squared plus b squared is not c squared for right angle triangles when the triangle is big enough and you do it with laser beams. So the non-trivial shape of a manifold manifests itself in the non-triviality of distances among the points. But there's another way of looking at the non-trivial shape of the manifold as well. And that is the non-triviality of parallel transport. The idea is simply this. If you are standing, for example, on the North Pole of the Earth, and you're stretching out your arm like this, and now you're walking towards the equator, so you're stretching out your arm, you're walking towards the equator, let's say this is the equator. You don't have to reach the equator for the purpose of this experiment here. And then, as you are at the equator, you walk on the equator like this, right? And you just follow the equator. Always, you never turn or anything, you just walk. Always parallel transporting your arm. And then after a while, you're over there, and you walk backwards towards the North Pole. Then obviously, you're no longer pointing in the same direction as you started out. This sort of thing will never happen on a flat space. If on a flat space, you walk some direction, and then you change direction, do a parallelogram or something, arrive at the original point. If you always parallel transported your arm, it's going to point in the same direction as you started out with. So a method for seeing whether a space is curved or not is to check whether the parallel transport of vectors is non-trivial or trivial. it's an alternative to checking whether Pythagoras holds. And so we are in, we are soon now switching to this new point of view, or actually the old point of view, for how the non-triviality of the shape of the manifold is described. Maybe not to the non-triviality of distances, but to the non-triviality of parallel transport. And for that purpose, we will study the covariant differentiation, which is based on the notion of parallel transport and is asking how much does a vector field change direction as I parallel transport. Right? I think we are out of time for today. Are there any questions?
I have a question about the Klein-Gordon equation.
Mm-hmm.
So, but you consider the real value Klein-Gordon field, which describes the chargeless particles. But if we were to study a complex field, which would describe particles with charge, does it change like conceptually the scheme? Because like we have these n forms, which are actually real forms.
Yeah, but that's right. But the thing is that since the Laplace operator is a real operator, it's not mixing real and imaginary parts.
Oh.
So it all changes. I should say perhaps another thing, which is that the Laplace operator obviously depends in a complicated fashion on how the space-time looks like, because it depends on the metric. Remember this expression there. Where is it? Yeah, here. The Laplace operator acts in this complicated fashion on our functions A. So given the shape of the manifold, given the metrics, so you can calculate what the action of the denominator is. The amazing thing is that to a large extent it also works the other way around. If you only know the Laplace operator, you can calculate how the manifold works. That is the subject of the discipline of spectral geometry that I will talk some more about later on. Basically, the message is this. If you have a Riemannian manifold, and I should say Riemannian rather than pseudo-Riemannian, because it's not as much left for pseudo-Riemannian. If you have a pseudo-Riemannian manifold of a finite size, and you look at its Laplacian, it has a discrete spectrum, just like the Hamiltonian of a system confined to a finite space. Also has essentially just a second derivative operator from the kinetic term, and its spectrum is discrete. Here also the Laplacian on a finite piece of Riemannian manifold has a discrete spectrum. Very similar. And just like in quantum mechanics, when you have the Laplacian of a finite size system, and its spectrum is discrete, then you can generally, up to some little caveats, you can actually reconstruct the potential from Hamiltonian. Here, you can actually reconstruct the shape of the manifold from the spectrum of the Laplace. Let me just rephrase it. In quantum mechanics, normally, you're given the potential, let's say the Schrödinger equation with the Coulomb potential for the hydrogen atom, and then, given the potential, you sweat a lot, work a lot, and then eventually you find out what the spectrum of the Hamiltonian is. For example, you find out what the hydrogen atom spectrum is. Okay? What I'm saying is that if somebody gave you a spectrum, like the hydrogen atom spectrum, you could actually calculate backwards what the potential is that leads to the spectrum. So if somebody just gives you the spectrum, then you can calculate what its potential is. This is not exotic, this is the regular thing. See, let's say in chemistry, what do you think is easier to measure? The spectrum of a molecule or the potential of it? Much easier to measure the spectrum. So it's actually a realistic question. If I only know the spectrum, what can I tell about potential? And then as a setup to some caveats, you can tell what the potential was and calculate it back. And similarly, from the spectrum of the manifold, you can tell its shape. It's as if you were taking a manifold, think of it as a piece of metal, and you take a stick and bang on it, it will make some sound. And you hear its spectrum, so you hear its eigenvalues of its Laplace. And then the sound will tell you, not always, but most of the time it will tell you what the shape of the manifold is. I will put a little bit of that spectral geometry later into the course. this is all extra stuff. You're done for today. Any other questions?
Is there a lecture on Monday?
Monday is what? It's some sort of holiday.
Thanksgiving.
Right. Yeah, so let's give our thanks. Very good. I wouldn't mind doing the course, but I don't think I can insist on that, because some of you may have plans to go somewhere or something. So, no, there won't be an intro there. I still haven't found out about the replacement lectures yet. Remember that when there's this, when there will be this Quantum Cosmos Festival, there will be a lot of action in the building. And we will have to either double up our lectures after the festival or move them to later in the day, something like that.
So we should apply the principle of least action, so then we can have the
Well, we have a lot of lectures to go through, so we cannot wait any time. Has everybody received an email from me yet?
I forgot to send you.
Right. I forgot to do that.
All right. Just send me an email so that I can keep you up to date about this business. Because I don't know, we may already have a change for our next lecture, which is next week on Thursday.
When does Quantum Cosmos start?
15th, yes. What date is next Thursday? It is the 15th? Okay.
I do have a request. We're going to double the time or doing it later. Can we do it just on Thursdays? Because Mondays, it's impossible. Mm-hmm. It would take 2 weeks, but
yeah. Monday's bad for me as well.
Okay. All right.
Mm-hmm. Thursdays, I don't mind being here.
Okay. Right, okay. I'll check with the folks here. Okay. Any other questions? Yes?
I'm wondering about the time shortening equation.
Yes?
You have a little note about, when you add math, is that some squared?
Are you asking? I can hardly hear you because you're very quiet. Are you asking about a mass term in the Tangon equation?
Yeah, you have the little note on the slide that says with mass you add the m squared.
Yes.
Why does that mean this mass squared?
Oh, okay, I can tell you. Oh, by the way, does everybody know how to divide e equal mc squared? You guys should know that, all right, by now. What e equal mc squared? Basically, that's what your question was about, because what do we have?